This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're passionate students of history here at Radio Boston. And in this digital world of ours, one marked by a breathless pace of change, our next guest says, look back at more than 100 years to see how people really grappled with the most profound change our species has yet endured. The tipping point, if you will, when humanity passed from being part of nature to controlling it, from a world marked by the rhythms of rivers, sun, and tide, to one beholden to the rhythms of machines. In other words, look at humanity and how it handled the Industrial Revolution. Rosalind Williams says the best way to understand that revolution is through close examination of three major writers and artists of the 19th and early 20th centuries. Williams is a professor in MIT's Science, Technology, and Society program, and she's author of the new book, The Triumph of Human Empire, Verne, Morris, and Stevenson, at the end of the world, and she joins me now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, the triumph of human empire, what exactly do you mean by that?
It is a rather grandiose title, isn't it? But it's meant to be, because I'm pointing to this event that you were just describing, this tipping point in history when history becomes something that is played out on a set largely built by human beings themselves. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't actually use the word control. This is not a planet that humans control, but we dominate it.
Right.
And so that is the tipping point that is the topic of the book. And you could call it environmental history. You could call it history of technology. But it's all that. Yes, it's the Industrial Revolution, but actually it's more than that, too.
Well, why did you decide to look at what we can glean from this era through three writers, Jules Verne, William Morris, who was also an artist, and Robert Louis Stevenson?
I went to the writers because this event that I'm talking about is, in the end, it's an event of consciousness. It's an event of human beings being aware of this new self-created environment. There are a lot of material measures. You can use a whole set of measures of population or consumption or species depletion, but in the end, it's an event of awareness. Mm. And nobody is more aware than writers, than artists. And they really see over the horizon and they sense things that are happening before the rest of us have language for those events. So they didn't have words like environment or technology, or if they had them, they were rarely used. But they're much more keenly aware of what's going on just because they don't have that kind of standard language.
And you know what was interesting to me is the three writers that you've chosen all had rather complicated relationships with this new world that they found themselves in. It wasn't either just, you know, pure technophobia or anti-modernism versus, a blind love for all of progress. They sort of had a mishmash somewhere in between. Although sometimes, I was looking at, for example, some writings of William Morris, the writer, poet, and artist as well. And there's one quote of his that really jumped out at me. He said, "So long as the system of competition in the production and exchange of the means of life goes on, the degradation of the arts will go on. And if that system is to last forever, then art is doomed and will surely die. That is to say, civilization will die." He wasn't so keen on all of it.
Well, this is why I say it's a grandiose topic, because these three writers are all saying that civilization, as it's conventionally defined, is a problem for them. And what's so odd is they, of course, as white bourgeois males of Western Europe, they are the most privileged of this new order, and yet they're deeply troubled by it because they all see civilization as going against things that they treasure the most. And you just quoted Morris. He loves the art, and he considers the arts as the basis of labor. So his whole concept is, I'm not just talking about the fine arts, I'm talking about people working in daily life. That pleasure, that joy in labor is disappearing. So that's a very fundamental critique.
Well, so talk to me a little bit about what you see in Jules Verne then. He's obviously best known for 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. What is he telling us there?
Well, of course, 20,000 Leagues is often read as this nifty technological fantasy of this wonderful submarine that can do marvelous things. And doesn't Verne love this stuff? Well, he does. Verne is a great enthusiast of vehicles like that and of inventions. But if you look at the story, not the submarine, but the story. Captain Nemo, who is captain of the submarine, is trying to escape civilization. Mm. And he says at one point when his captives are saying to him, "Why are you holding us captive? That's not a civilized thing to do." Captain Nemo says, he folds his arms defiantly and says, "I am not a civilized man." Mm-hmm. He's trying to get away from a world that that in the story has, you know, killed his wife and family, and that he regards as just full of cruelty and exploitation. So the storyline is not at all an excitement for civilization. It really is a critique of it.
Now, forgive me if you've already said this, but it just sort of triggered something in my mind. I'd like to just explore it a little further. All three of these men, and correct me if I'm wrong, could essentially afford to be a little dubious about the mechanical and industrial progress all around them by virtue of sort of their station in life, right? Because regardless of what happened, they were going to benefit. Their lives were going to get better, whereas perhaps others who were working in the factories didn't necessarily have that same space in their lives to be critical of the new jobs that they had, yeah, no matter how horrible they were.
But the point is that even these men who in theory would benefit feel that their lives, even the lives of the privileged, are being degraded. I mean, to go back to Morris, what bothers him is just that he runs a company where they make decorative arts. He tries to run it in a humane way. But he realizes that all around him, the world is not like that, that he can have a little island, but he's aware of the larger world. Someone like Stevenson, who's trained as a professional engineer, mm-hmm. he has his degree in engineering. But when he goes to the South Pacific in the 1890s and sees what engineering is doing there in the sense of the exploitation of the islands for crops and the exploitation of the people for labor, he's horrified at what he sees. So it's not as if they live in a world where they are privileged and others aren't. They feel their world is really connected much more largely, and they're much more troubled by the larger connections that they're very aware of.
It's you just change if you changed names and dates, a lot of this would ring very familiar for people in 2013. But the subtitle of your book contains the phrase "the end of the world." What about it was ending for them?
There's three ways you could interpret that. It's ending in the sense that the world is finally being completely mapped in the 1890s. Not completely. There's still the Arctic and the Antarctic. But the end of the world has been reached in space, in the sense of human beings being able to map the entire planet. That has not been true, had not been true before.
No more dragons.
That's
out there.
Yes. Or, well, there's a lot that you can map going up, going down, but in terms of standard geography, that's been done. The end of the world in time is more troubling to them because they feel as if the dangers of civilization that they perceive, that they wonder where this is all headed, and they are all troubled deeply by where it's headed. Again, to quote Stevenson, when he looks at the South Pacific, he says, "The West is flowing, the West is bringing a tide of death to the South Pacific. It is dying. We are not going to see this civilization again." So it's in time. But then also there's a sense the world I care about most is disappearing. And whatever I do, it's still disappearing. It's a very frustrated, angry, and yet courageous stance.
Well, many lessons to take away from this wonderful new book. Chief amongst them is that the struggles we face today, we have struggled with before.
Yes, there is a history.
Rosalind Williams is professor in the Science, Technology, and Society program at MIT. Her new book is The Triumph of Human Empire, Jules Verne, William Morris, and Robert Louis Stevenson at the End of the World. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for today, everyone. Join us again tomorrow. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.